This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. It's been more than 3 weeks since a Malaysian Airlines flight headed for China veered off course, then ceased communications and seemingly disappeared into thin air. In the absence of concrete evidence, theories on what happened inside the cockpit of the plane and where it ended up have abounded. International search teams are currently focusing their efforts on the southern Indian Ocean, but so far have turned up nothing to lead them to a possible crash site for flight MH370. Unfortunately, this isn't the first time a large airliner has crashed into the sea. On June 1st, 2009, Air France Flight 447 from Rio de Janeiro to Paris crashed into the middle of the southern Atlantic Ocean, killing all 228 people aboard. Although some wreckage and even bodies were recovered from the surface within days, it took 2 years to find the complete wreckage, including the black box, buried under thousands of meters of water atop the Mid-Atlantic Ridge. Dave Gallo and Mike Purcell, both of HUI, were the co-leaders of the Deep Ocean Search and Recovery Mission. They've been called on by many media outlets recently, and so we're happy to have Mike here with us now to have a more extensive conversation about the Air France search and what lessons might apply to the ongoing Malaysian Airlines search effort. Mike Purcell, welcome to Living Lab.
Thank you. Good morning.
Now, before we start, I want to just make it really clear for listeners what your role or lack of role in the current Malaysian Airlines search is. HUI, Woodsville Oceanographic Institution, has offered services, but you're not currently involved in this search.
That's correct. I think the services were offered to the U.S. government that we would provide assistance if needed, but no steps have been taken in that direction.
Okay. So I'm assuming, though, on both a personal and professional level that you've been kind of following this search. And at the moment, there are search teams out in the middle of the southern Indian Ocean. They've actually been training satellites on this area of the ocean looking for evidence of debris. They've found three possible debris fields. But we just got the news this morning that any debris that they've actually brought on board a ship is not related to the crash. I mean, is this just a symptom of the state of the ocean today? Could we pretty much look in any part of the ocean and find debris?
That's definitely true. I think there are certainly places in the ocean where it tends to congregate. I'm not exactly sure if this is one of those areas or at least the search areas they've been looking in, but there is a lot of floating material throughout the ocean.
So, are you surprised that they haven't found debris for this flight yet?
Well, I think it's been very challenging in the case that they just don't know where the plane flew. They have these indications from satellites that it flew down into the southern Indian Ocean. They've changed sort of their search area once by quite a large distance. They don't have great information on where the plane was potentially before it went in the water.
Now, if some of this other debris, I mean, they've got three different debris fields that they've kind of been looking at, separated in some cases by hundreds of miles. If some of this debris turned out to be from the flight, clearly that's not actually where the plane went down. I mean, we're 3 weeks later. What chance do they have at this point of being able to back calculate and figure out where the plane actually did go down?
Well, I think that it's unlikely that the debris would be at the location of the flight. That's true. And it's probably traveled some distance. It does depend on the currents and the wind and the waves in that area over the last 3 weeks. I think that you'd be able to make some calculations or estimations on where it originated. And potentially that could be combined sort of with the information from the satellites. And hopefully those two pieces of information would sort of indicate that the plane accident happened, you know, in a small or, you know, a location that might be searched with underwater assets.
Right. So when you're talking about the satellite data, there's kind of that arc that they say from some data that satellites were receiving from the plane is the range of possibilities of where it flew. And they could kind of combine that arc with how winds and currents have been moving over the past few weeks to pin
it down. Exactly. I think both sets of information need to be used to get a good potential location of the plane.
I mean, how narrow a search area do you need before you can launch an underwater search?
Well, I think right now it's getting close to the end of the battery life of the pingers that are attached to the flight recorders. So you're going to have to conduct this search with using side scan sonar from either towed vehicles and or underwater autonomous vehicles. And each of one of those can go in the water and maybe cover 25 to 40 nautical miles a day. So if you've only got one out there, then you know you're going to be doing about 200 square nautical miles a week. And you know the search areas they're talking about now are absolutely huge. So I think it's got to be the area's got to be reduced significantly.
All right, I'm talking with Mike Purcell, principal engineer in Applied Ocean Physics and Engineering at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. He was one of the co-leaders of a Woods Hole-based team that helped find the wreckage of Air France Flight 447 back in 2011. So Mike, let's shift to that search now. What actually happened to Air France Flight 447?
Well, the flight was flying from Rio de Janeiro to Paris, and it was just crossing the equator, and it entered an area of bad weather. And I think all the pitot tubes froze up, so there was no speed indication for the plane. The pilots took over control of the plane, and I think made some mistakes in how they handled it, and the plane ended up stalling and then falling into the ocean.
Now, how soon after the actual crash did you and the team from Woods Hole get involved in searching for the wreckage?
It was quite a while before our group got involved, and the accident happened in June, and we were out there the first time in late March of 2010, so 9-10 months later. The French were out there in an international search. Was conducted. They spent about 3 months during the summer of 2009 looking. They did not have success. They stopped at that time and did a big modeling effort to try and predict where the airplane might be. That took most of the fall, and at the same time, the planning was going on for the search teams to go out the following spring. So, it took a long time to find this the airplane, but a lot of it was spent more in planning and thinking about what the best way to go about it was, rather than searching the entire time frame.
Well, and where did the idea to pull your team and your technology and these underwater search vehicles into this search come from? I mean, I guess that's. Prior to that, wasn't necessarily standard protocol for finding a commercial airline.
Right. I think that lots of times, at least in the United States, a company called Phoenix International, which does a lot of salvage work for the Navy, gets called in to work on accidents of this nature. And I think in this case, the search area was so large, you know, it's much smaller than the current accident search area, but it was 5,000 square nautical miles. And it would take months to search it, especially with one vehicle. There were some issues in that search in that the terrain was pretty severe, and towed vehicles don't do a great job in really rough terrain. So I think that Huey was involved in the modeling effort to try and predict where the plane had crashed, and so that just sort of led to discussions about using some of our vehicles to go out and help with the search.
All right. So just to kind of recap, I mean, you said that they kind of narrowed it down, if you can call 5,000 square miles narrowed down.
Yeah.
They'd modeled this search area, and you said it was several months before you got out there. Some wreckage was found at the surface immediately. So what was known? What were your knowns when you headed out to start this search?
There were a lot of knowns. Number one, the plane continued to report its last known position about every 10 minutes. So they had a recent position before the accident. It ended up being about 4.5 minutes before. The plane was sending out some ACARS messages, which are sort of automatic maintenance messages. And they continued to be sent out for about 4.5 minutes after that last known position. So that provided a potential window for how long the plane stayed in the air after that last known position. They could project how far the plane would fly in that time frame. And then the debris was found in an area fairly close to the last known position, and it tended to be 30 to 40 miles north of that last known position. And over the 5 or 6 days that they continued to pick up debris, it kept drifting to the north. But all three of those things provided sort of a conclusive evidence that the plane was in the area close to that last known position.
I mean, very, very differently than with the current search, that seems to be almost the best case scenario if you're going to have to do a deep ocean search.
Agreed. And I mean, the current situation, the ACARs were turned off. The transponder was turned off. So there was no more transmission of last known position. And we haven't found any debris. So all three things that we had are not present with this current accident.
Now, and of course, you kind of alluded to earlier the fact that with the Malaysian Airlines flight, we're approaching the point where the black box pinger is going to run out of battery life. Clearly, by 9 to 10 months after the Air France search, you had no pinger data to go on there.
Correct. We didn't have any. Well, the pinger for our search, it actually ended up being sort of a... it's something that sent us off in the wrong direction, I think, because they were down to listen for the pinger early enough in the case of the Air France accident, and they didn't hear anything. And they, from the records, it shows that they went very close to where the crash site was, and the pingers were on the seafloor. And later, when the pinger, when the flight recorders recovered, we were able to recover one pinger, and it was partially damaged. So it's not clear whether that happened in the 2 months it was underwater, or excuse me, almost 2 years it was in water, or it happened during the accident. But in that case,
maybe they just went down and it was damaged. They couldn't hear it because it wasn't pinging.
That's right. And I think that sort of shifted the search, the first search that we went out on in 2010, away from the crash site, because they had already searched there for with the pinger listening device.
So, I mean, so when you say they were down and listening, you with the towed pinger locator. So this is a sensor basically that's towed behind another boat at another ship.
Exactly.
At the surface.
Exactly. The pinger is down on the seafloor. It's pinging about once a minute, and then you just tow a listening device that can hear that sound.
And it can be heard even through thousands of meters of water up to the surface.
No, it can't be heard up to the surface. It's probably a pretty solid range is 2,000 meters, so a little bit more than a mile. That's one of the issues with these pingers and flying over the deep ocean. You know, you would think that this would be a lot simpler if a boat towing something at the surface could hear a pinger down 4,000 meters below.
So they were actually having to tow it
They're
1,000, 2,000 meters depth.
Or even down deeper in some areas, correct? So they were probably towing it 750 meters above the seafloor. So in some cases, that water was 4,000 meters deep. So it's towed really deep. So that goes slow, too. That's another thing. And that's a characteristic of the underwater search, is planes are flying at 5,000 miles an hour, but probably not when they're looking. But we're... towing at like 3 knots or 3 miles an hour. So that's one reason why the coverage is only 25 square miles a day.
And is there any technology that could essentially be deployed at the surface and see the bottom in any way to help search the bottom of the ocean at these depths while still being at the surface? Or do you have to be down at depth?
You have to be down there. I mean, underwater acoustics are the primary sensor. But one of the... you can get high resolution with high frequency acoustics. The problems are they're absorbed after short distances by the water, so you cannot go long range at high resolution. So you can't make out a lot of details about the seafloor when it's in deep water.
That's Mike Purcell, Principal Engineer in Applied Ocean Physics and Engineering at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. He was one of the co-leaders of the team that found the wreckage of the Air France Flight 447 at the bottom of the Southern Atlantic Ocean back in 2011. We're talking this hour about that search and what lessons might be learned from that search that could help with the current attempt to find a missing Malaysian Airlines flight. We'll talk more after a short break. Welcome back to Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. We're talking with Mike Purcell, one of the leaders of the team that found the wreckage of Air France Flight 447 on the bottom of the Atlantic 3 years ago. Now, before the break, Mike, you were talking a little bit about the technology that is necessary to actually search for the wreckage of an airplane, and in particular, the black box, that information that we're always looking for in any of these investigations. And you were talking about how you basically have to be at depth. There's nothing that can see through the 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 meters of water that we were talking about, that you were dealing with in terms of the Air France wreck, or that we would potentially be looking at with the current Indian Ocean situation with the Malaysian Airlines. So what is the technology that you were able to bring to the Air France search, the vehicles and what they're capable of?
So we used autonomous underwater vehicles. And I guess the analogy is we hear a lot about drones, aircraft drones, you know, unmanned aircraft flying around. And so these are the same thing underwater. And they swim a mission plan that we program. And in this case, we're using vehicles called the REMA 6000 that can swim in water depths down to 6,000 meters. And so that's about almost 4 miles. And they carry a lot of different sensors on them. And they can map the seafloor, measure water properties, take pictures of the seafloor. You know, lots of different things that have been done over the years in all sorts of oceanographic work can be accomplished with these vehicles.
And so give us some examples. What sorts of things, because searching for a crashed airplane is not your everyday job. What are you usually doing with REMUS? What is REMUS usually searching for or doing?
Well, underwater vehicles like this are used by the Navy, and they've been a big funder of their development, and their big initial requirement was to use the vehicles to find underwater mines. And I think in the past, they put people in the water to swim around and see if they could find mines. But the vehicles go in and do that job.
And when they're doing that, are they essentially doing it visually by taking pictures of the seafloor? Or are they doing it magnetically or in some other way finding those mines?
Well, they do it in a lot of different ways. So we have acoustic sensors, side-scan sonar, which we've mentioned a little bit, that maps the seafloor. It sends out sound pings, and then they rebound off the seafloor, and they come back to the vehicle where they're recorded. And when you get really strong signals, you can sort of guess whether something's man-made or it's a rock. But you can determine that if there are mines in an area. So that's one use. We've used them to map, to do a survey for scallops. Okay, and that's done both optically and with the acoustics. And going back to the mines, we've also used magnetic sensors, and we've used cameras on the vehicles to confirm whether we find an underwater mine or if it's just rocks. So the vehicles go into the water. They, depending on how many batteries they carry, they swim anywhere from about 8 hours to 2 or 3 days right now.
Wow.
And the deeper we go, the less batteries we can carry, because we need more metal to go into the vehicle to make it strong enough to withstand the depths. But
Are the batteries themselves affected in any way by the temperature or the pressure? I mean, being very cold and at pressure at depth.
In our situation, the batteries are in these housings that keep them at the same pressure that we see at the surface. So they're not affected. And it's lithium ion batteries, the kind of battery you find in your laptop. So they work pretty much the same. But they'll, like I said, the vehicles that go into the deep water can run around on the seafloor for about a day. Then they come back up to the surface. When the vehicle comes back up, we recover it. The big thing is to get the data off quick so we can look at it. We change the batteries. We reprogram the next mission. And we try and get the vehicle back in the water in 3 to 4 hours. And when you're running three vehicles, then it's pretty busy all the time.
So three vehicles is what you took out to search for Air France. And I mean, were they essentially doing, you know, like 3 8-hour shifts to be going 24 hours or?
Well, you always start off with a little separation so that it's not crazy on deck with lots of vehicles. But something happens with one vehicle and it gets delayed going back in the water, or as it terminates its mission a little bit early. So all this, so it's always a juggling match. But the idea is to only have, you know, the goal is to have one vehicle on this, only one vehicle on the ship at any one time, and have the other two running, and also to quickly get the vehicle back into the water.
So if you've got two on the seafloor, are they working completely independently, or are they talking to each other in any way or interacting?
In this case, they are not interacting at all, although that's being worked on and has been worked on in the past. But in this case of the search for the Air France plane, we sort of designated an area where we wanted each vehicle to cover, and it would swim a track back and forth across that area, not unlike mowing your lawn. And as it swims along, it looks out almost a half mile to each side of the vehicle, and gets reflections from the seafloor of the acoustic ping that's sent out.
Now, you've mentioned the different configurations that you can use on REMUS, all sorts of different sensors. From the time that the idea came up to use these vehicles to search for the Air France wreckage till you were actually ready to go with to sea with them, how long was that? Was it a pretty quick, this is what they're also ready to set up to do, or did you have to make some modifications?
We did not modify the vehicles for the trip the first time down. You know, the biggest issue was just some planning to get on the vessel we were going to get on. It was a Norwegian vessel. It was a pretty crowded back deck, so we had to figure out how we were going to fit our equipment on. We had two vehicles here. We also worked with a German research group, GeoMar. They provided a third vehicle, but we were involved in getting them on the team. I think it took about, you know, 3-4 weeks to get the equipment down to Brazil. We had to go down there and load it on the ship and get it ready to go. And then we left from Brazil out to the search area the first time.
A lot of logistics you don't necessarily think about in just getting a team of experts in the vehicles out to sea.
Yeah, but although I think it's pretty typical for any oceanographic cruise with a lot of equipment that's, you know, happens every month here at Woods Hole. So it's people understand what it involves. And so it's not a, you know, really, it doesn't make the job necessarily take longer. It's just part of the job.
This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. I'm talking with Mike Purcell, one of the leaders of the team from Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution that found the wreckage of Air France Flight 447 3 years ago. If you'd like to join our conversation, the number is 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Now, Mike, talk to me about that first dive. You know, it's 10 months after the wreck. You've been doing all this work to get ready. What are the emotions and the expectations the first time you put one or two of these vehicles into the water, headed down to the bottom of the ocean? I mean, are you in any way hoping that you could find the wreckage of the plane that day?
Yeah, you're always hopeful you're going to find it. We were on a ship with a lot of people that were very anxious to find the wreckage. So it sort of builds a little, I don't know what the
some
right
tension.
Term is, some tension or
some
whatever.
Excitement.
But, you know, the first four or five missions, or maybe three or four missions we ran down there, the vehicles just got, we had to learn a few things. And
like what?
Well, we were in this valley, a very flat terrain, but on either side of it were very steep mountains.
And so you're talking about the bottom of the
yes,
ocean,
exactly.
Not where you were the ship
right.
on the
I'm
surface.
I'm talking about exactly. And so we were doing fine swimming along those flat areas, and then the mountains on either side were incredibly steep, and we effectively, the vehicles just ran right into them. And so
I mean, did they literally run into them and get damaged?
They literally ran right into them. They didn't get damaged, but in one case, you know, we have drop weight and we have a release float to help us recover it. In one case, the drop weight got released, so that terminated the mission and it came back up. So we learned quick some lessons on how we were going to do this. And so then we got moving and started covering some ground at a much higher rate.
So how long was that first search cruise? I mean, were you out there for a week, 2 weeks, a month?
In 2010, we were out there twice. I think we were at sea probably a total of almost 60 days, 55 days. It was split up about 30 days and then 25 days was the split. So
was there ever a point, you know, going from this initial almost hype, you know, you're talking about the tension, the excitement, the anticipation, hoping that you might find this, hoping that you might find it, to 60 days of searching later, thinking we're never going to find this?
Yeah, I don't think so. I think that once you get out there, you got three vehicles, you have navigation beacons that you have to deploy to the seafloor. It really becomes a job that's very routine. You're doing the same thing every day.
As you said, it's like mowing your lawn.
Right. It's like mowing your lawn, right? And the people in our team, we had 12 people out there to run the three vehicles. They're doing 12-hour watches of six people on each watch. And they just do what's got to be done. And that's either get the vehicle in and out of the water or out and then back in, programming the mission, looking at data, preparing the navigation beacons to be deployed, or deploying those, recovering them. And you just get in this routine where you do that. And it's, you know, it sort of takes you away from the, what your real goal is out there, but it's what's got to be done to meet the goal.
All right, I want to talk more about getting that done, but we've got a couple of callers who want to join the conversation. Adam is giving us a call from Harwich. What's on your mind, Adam?
Yeah, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I was wondering if the Navy's SOSUS, S-O-S-U-S, underwater listening array, which is deployed around the world but is still considered pretty classified, would be of any use in detecting the pings from the black boxes on the sea floor. And if so, whether or not there would be any issues of technological sensitivity that might complicate using that data in the search?
It's a great question, Adam. Yeah. So could this, there? So essentially this is a system that was set up to listen for subs during the Cold War. Could this be used in any way?
I think that the issue here is that the pingers on the black boxes have a pretty high frequency, about 37.5 kilohertz. So that's absorbed pretty quickly by the seawater. So unless the accident was very close to one of these cables, then it's really unlikely that that would help out.
All right. And Tom is calling us from New Bedford. Tom, you're on the air.
Hi, yes, I had almost the same question. I was wondering whether nuclear subs would have been any help. I know their passive sonar is very sensitive and is also classified, so I wondered whether there should be nuclear subs somewhere in that area just trolling around listening for the pings as well.
Once again, I think it's it could be a depth of water issue and how low the pingers are. I do know that the French used one of their nuclear submarines during the Air France search to try and listen for the pingers.
Could one of those submarines with their sonar essentially do the same sort of job that you're talking about? I mean, the Remus vehicle that you guys were using, really, if you just look at it, it looks like a big yellow torpedo, almost like a little tiny underwater submarine. Could they do the same job?
Well, in our case, our vehicle's making the sound, it's going out, it's bouncing off the seafloor, and it's coming back to us and recording it. And submarines may have some of that capability, but I think, at least in the case of the Air France accident, the French did use their submarine to just listen for the pingers. I think in the end, that wasn't effective. They also had the issue where at the same time they're towing things through the water in deep water. The subs, they have to make sure things aren't in the same area where they're working.
And especially the kind of terrain that you were talking about, this mountainous terrain and valleys, clearly having a much smaller vehicle is going to be an asset.
Yes, and the submarine can't, generally don't go as deep probably as where that deeper terrain is. So there's a listening issue because of the depth limits on the sub, and then there's just, I guess the big issue with the black boxes is how long the batteries last, and in both cases, there was delays in getting out there, and so there's limited time to listen for them.
Now, so I want to go back to what you actually did end up doing to search for Air France, and you've been, talking about these small vehicles going out using their sideband sonar, this ability to acoustically map the sea floor for about a half mile in either direction. They're out there for hours. You've got three of these vehicles basically doing it around the clock. And then you just kind of mentioned the fact that you've got this crew on top who's looking at data. I mean, what do you mean by looking at data? Are they literally just looking at reams and reams and reams of pictures of the seafloor?
Well, yeah, sort of. So every time the vehicle goes down, it comes back up. It's got 25 square nautical miles of acoustic data. And basically, we process that a little bit and put it on the screen, and then you can sort of play it like in a waterfall viewer that just, it's almost a view as the submarine, as our underwater vehicle swimming along, we see the data. And it's a little bit challenging if the terrain's rough. We're trying to distinguish man-made objects in an area where it could be lots of rocks, side of a mountain, and, that part of it's potentially really difficult. Man-made objects do exhibit probably stronger returns than rocks that have been sitting down there on the bottom and having sediment fall on them for millions of years. They've been down there for a short time frame. There's sharp edges. There's objects that, resonate at different frequencies. So there are some indicators in the data that in some reflections that suggest it's man-made.
But in the end, this does basically come back to a human visual search. You don't have a computer that's going through and saying, oh, here was a strong return. Look at this. You're not filtering this through some automated computer program.
We are not doing that, although that's starting to happen in some applications. And we're actually trying to work on it for finding something which would show you a large debris field in a relatively flat area where there wasn't a lot of other potential things. We are working on that to hopefully incorporate that in the future.
All right. That's Mike Purcell, Principal Engineer in Applied Ocean Physics and Engineering at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. He was one of the leaders of the team that found the wreckage of the Air France Flight 447 3 years ago. We'll talk more about lessons from that search that might help with the current search for a missing Malaysian Airlines plane after a short break. This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. I'm talking with Mike Purcell, Principal Engineer in Applied Ocean Physics and Engineering at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. He co-led the team that found the wreckage of Air France Flight 447 on the bottom of the Atlantic 3 years ago. Now, Mike, let's fast forward. We were talking about some of the challenges and the day-to-day routine of the search. Four search missions, 2 years later, you guys actually found the wreckage. What changed, or what happened, or was it literally just a matter of mowing your way through the entire possible search area?
Yeah, I think it definitely was looking in the right place. We went out there in the first time we went out in 2010, the search area that we were assigned was sort of based on the modeling work that had been done leading up to it, based on where the debris was. And sort of shifted in that area because of the lack of success searching more close to the last known position when they were trying to listen for the black box pingers.
So kind of a matter of also keeping an open mind, not saying, you didn't hear it there, it's not there, but keeping that open as a possibility.
Right, although there was a lot of determination on the French's part, on France to find the plane. So we went out there in 2011 with the idea that we were going to search the remaining 30, 3,400 square nautical miles that we had not looked at. And we had planned for three cruises, probably down there for over 4 months. And
You were saying earlier that you were looking at the search for the Air France wreckage making up like 1% of your total life after the age of 50 or something.
Right, if I live to 100. that was... So we were planning for a big effort, and but we decided, or the emphasis at the start would be to go back close to the last known position, and we started looking. And on about the eighth day of the cruise, we found the wreck. We got a sonar return of the debris field. It was in an area of very flat terrain, almost 4,000 meters deep. It's definitely not something that was, coming, if you looked in that area all around that, there was nothing that would be similar to that that was natural. And so we reprogrammed, sent the next, we did put two more missions in the water, and then we went and put the vehicle back in the water to go take pictures of that site. And so normally when we're doing the side scan, the vehicle swims about 220 feet, 70 meters above the seafloor. And then when we're taking pictures, we swim about 10 meters or 33 feet above the seafloor. And we went over the location, and the pictures, vehicle came back up to the surface. We started downloading, and it confirmed that we had found the crash site.
What was the mood like on board? I mean, I imagine there's got to be this incredible mix of elation that you've found what you're looking for, and yet what you've just found is a deadly wreck.
Right, definitely. It was a big accomplishment for us. A lot of us have been working on these vehicles for a long time, and then to go out and use them, making a contribution, and finding the wreck was a big event for us, but it was very sobering in that we're finding the wreckage of a tragic event.
Now, what was recovered and how? I mean, the vehicles that were down there searching don't have any robotic arms or the capacity to haul a big chunk of an airplane to the surface. So,
correct. So what we did is after we found it and got those first images, we started taking, we ran six more missions over the site. And we took about 90,000 pictures so that we could make a map or a mosaic of the wreck site. And then we headed back into shore. We sent all that data to the French. One of our processing guys did go out on the next cruise. They had already set up a boat and a recovery crew to go out. And they used remote operated vehicles, which are vehicles that have a cable running back up to shore. They have more power. They've got arms, manipulators. And so they went back out, and the first thing they did was recover the search and recover the black boxes. And they got them both back, and they were in pristine condition from the standpoint that all the data on both the voice recorder and the data recorder were available to the inspectors. And then they started recovering what they thought might be critical components. And those were engines, computer, other flight computers. I can't remember all the stuff, but they probably spent 2 weeks picking stuff off the seafloor.
Now, going into this, they already had some wreckage. They already had more data. There was already a theory essentially about what had happened, that they had lost their airspeed sensors that had caused, navigation problems. How much additional information came from what was recovered, and do you feel like it was worth the effort?
Well, first off, I'm definite that it was worth the effort for, a lot of reasons. One is... the flight recorders did provide an explanation of what happened to the airplane and why the accident had occurred. And, there were a lot of issues, a lot of discussion about whether the control systems that are used by Airbus were at fault or not. So I think that cleared up a lot of issues there. And so it provided a definite explanation for the accident. And I think it's probably leading to some changes for both airlines, the airline, and the manufacturer of the airplanes. I think that another reason why it was definite is that a lot of human remains were recovered from the accident. And I know from personal contact with some of the families that that was significant to them.
Now, is there any scientific value, I guess, for lack of a better term? Are there things that we learn just basically about the ocean, mapping the ocean, or that perhaps feed back to you improving your vehicles? Is there kind of a fundamental science value to doing these sorts of missions as well?
There definitely for us in doing this operation, and I'll just say that we found the wreck site on the 109th time that we put the vehicles in the water down there. And I think we left the site after 126 or 125 missions. So we did about 12 or 13 or more than that after we found it. So we learned a lot from our standpoint, and it helped us develop the vehicles a little bit more. And so that's great.
I mean, there must be a degree of the fine mapping, essentially, that you did of that region of the ocean that's very rare.
Yes, there is. You know, it's side scan data. I think the scientists like multi-beam data, but it does provide a lot of a good look at a Mid-Atlantic Ridge site. So that in that data, a lot of the data is available for if people want to look at it. So that's.
Do you know of any scientists who have subsequently used that data as the basis for other studies?
I know that. So one of the French scientists has used the data. There's been a couple of papers written on it. I know that the German guys that we were out there with have looked at the data, and some of the scientists at HUI have expressed interest in looking at the data. So there is that benefit.
Now, I want to kind of circle back to the situation with the missing Malaysian Airlines jet. We got news over the past week that the Navy is sending one sonar-equipped robot. You've been talking about how critical it was to have three, and also the fact that at the moment the search area is just enormous. But I wonder if we could talk a little bit about the challenges that might face a deep ocean search and recovery team, whoever that might end up being, looking for the Malaysian Airlines jet. I mean, is that search area, the size of the search area, really the primary challenge at the moment?
Well, I think that the search area right now is so large that it's almost not worth doing the underwater search because it's it just the search rate at the seafloor is very slow, and we're talking about an absolutely huge area. I mean, obviously, you could put the vehicle in one of the first 10 times it goes in the water, you could be fortunate enough to find it, but it's not. Practical, or you can't go in with the belief that you're going to be that lucky.
I mean, you had a search area starting off that was what, a few thousand square miles, and I saw one estimate. You know that even if you were just kind of roughly taking the area over which the debris that they've kind of been looking at, which we now know is not actually related, but you know if you took kind of an area a few hundred miles by a few hundred miles, you're looking at tens of thousands of square miles
that
you've got to cover.
Right. And right. So we started off with the 5,000 square miles, and with three vehicles, it would potentially take us 4 months to look at that. So they're talking about maybe even at a minimum 25,000 square nautical miles with one vehicle. So they're talking about years of searching. And, you know, they're not even that confident right now in that 25,000 square nautical miles. So it's a tough undertaking right now.
If they were able to narrow the search site some, one of the greatest challenges that you faced, as you mentioned, was this seafloor terrain, the valleys, the mountains, the roughness of having to search, and even some of the challenges of being able to tell a piece of wreckage from a rock when you're in a rocky mountain situation. What is the seafloor like in the Indian Ocean, in the area of the world that might be the search area, and would that be a similar challenge?
Well, I think they've sort of moved this search area a little bit north, and from what they were looking at earlier last week. And for the most part, it's pretty flat, but there is one ridge that goes through it, so they would have some of the challenges that we had in that area, or whoever's out there looking. I think in the last week they were in this area that was in the Southern Ocean, where weather would be a real factor. You know, the most dangerous part of putting underwater vehicle operation is getting the vehicles in and out of the water, and particularly if it's rough. And so that would have been a challenge there.
I mean, we've already seen this search suspended multiple times because of weather.
Right, exactly. And if you have 30, 20-foot seas and stuff, you're putting your equipment at risk when you're going in and out of the water. And so that's a challenge. But they've moved the search area a little bit north. If it turns out that they find some wreckage there and decide to go ahead with underwater search, it may be a little bit calmer up there. And there is an issue where it is, you know, we're getting into spring here, but they're going into fall. So, you know, winter is, by the time you get a lot of assets down there, I mean, it may actually be winter. So that's going to be a factor in how effective you can be out there.
Are there advances that have taken place in the past 3 to 5 years in terms of submersible technology that might be a bit of an advantage here?
I don't think there really has been significant increases. It's sort of slow advancement, I think, right now. And, you know, the big advances we're looking at now are potentially increasing the endurance of vehicles, you know, adding some of this automatic target recognition that we spoke about earlier, and where the vehicle could sort of determine if it had found the wreckage on its own. And then the vehicle making decisions based on that sort of target recognition. For example, it would not have to come back up to the surface and have us reprogram it to go take pictures. It would just turn around and swoop down to a lower altitude and swim across the potential target and take pictures. So those kind of things are going on, but they're still in the testing stage and not implemented. So it's pretty much going to be vehicles in and out of the water once a day, twice a day, three times a day, depending on how many you have, and moving your navigation beacons and mowing the lawn.
Given the challenges that you've just outlined, are you confident that we will ever find this airplane?
It's still, I mean, I was more confident 2 weeks ago than I am right now. I think it's proving to be a real mystery. And, you know, I'm hopeful that the satellite information, which sort of shifted them to the Southern Indian Ocean area, will be the clue that sort of, you know, leads to finding some debris, and then we can backtrack to where the potential crash event was.
That's Mike Purcell, Principal Engineer in Applied Ocean Physics and Engineering at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, one of the leaders of the team that found the wreckage of Air France Flight 447 3 years ago. Thank you so much, Mike.
Thank you.
This is Living Lab. If you like what you hear, like Living Lab Radio on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. I'm Heather Goldstone. Thanks for listening.
Living Lab on the Point is produced by Heather Goldstone, with assistance from Jenny Junker and Alicia Orsini. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Major support for Living Lab is provided by the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment. Additional support from Michael and Roxanne Zach. Living Lab is a production of the Cape and Islands NPR stations, a service of WGBH.